tableau of magicians and their guardians revolved around the corpses. Books were hauled out of pockets or the insides of coats, read, abandoned. People would go in, work, leave, be replaced, return, stay, leave as more of the inhabitants of Canaan House arrived. Harrowhark worked for nearly 2 hours before fainting abruptly into a puddle of congealing blood, at which point Gideon had removed her from the scene. Upon waking, she shadowed the six instead, much to the ill-concealed annoyance of Camilla, who seemed to regard all incursions on Palamedes' personal space as probable assassination attempts. For his part, Palamedes talked quietly and briskly to Harrow, as though to a colleague he had known all his life.
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, episode 17, an active investigation.
Like this is the chapter where people like if they haven't started texting you about it, it's buckle up time.
Yeah, things get pretty weird in this chapter.
And now looking back on it, there's a lot of information in here, but it's presented in this really different rhythm from a lot of the writing previously in the book.
Yeah, I was noticing on this reread that the way that information is handled, like the flow of time in this chapter, is unusual. It's
Yes.
not like you're following Gideon along the action, it's more like Gideon is like telling you about it or remembering it. There's certain parts of it that she really remembers and connects with, but the scene opens with her saying six people tried to do this thing, and then she sort of unpacks what that looks like. It's really a different relationship with time than we get in most of the series.
Yeah, and it feels like the time like shifts back and forth where it goes from, recalling something to like hyper focusing on really minute actions, and we see some really specific types of necromancy as well in this one in those focusing in points. There's been some hints at it so far, but I think this is the biggest place where we get the Tridentarius twins' ruse start to kind of look weird.
Yeah, and Gideon notices that for all Eonthe had made fun of her sister's intellect, Corona never broke a sweat. So it's set up to suggest, like, oh, Corona actually isn't the one who's struggling to keep up. Eonthe is the one struggling to keep up. And you're really sort of pitched to go, oh, Corona just isn't as stupid as Eonthe said. Corona is actually like a really powerful necromancer. And of course, in hindsight, you're like, oh, Corona wasn't breaking a sweat because Corona wasn't fucking doing anything.
She was just acting.
Yeah.
And I'm curious too, like, what their experience would be if so much of Eanthe's necromancy that is observed by others is done in concert with Corona. Her necromancy, does it look strikingly different when she is not performing simultaneously? Or is she doing her necromancy and Corona is like, orbiting around Eanthe making improvise? Like, I imagine at this point in their lives, they've been doing this for a while, and there's a bit of a routine to the way they do it.
Yeah, they've been doing this probably 15 plus years at this point
Yeah.
because they're what, 21, 22? And they would have had to start this by the time they were five.
I'm doing some math here. That's five houses. Yeah.
So six
What?
necromancers tried to raise them plus Dulcinea. So the six necromancers, I made a note as we went.
Okay.
So Palamedes, who does the blood thing. Totally involved. Super. Palamedes is involved, like first and last, practically. Isaac, who does the blood thing. Corona, who's involved but doesn't do the blood thing, but is perceived to have tried to raise the dead in collaboration with Eonthe, who does the blood thing. Harrow, presumably, but doesn't do the blood. Silas at the end. So that makes six. And then Dulcinea. makes a gesture as if she's going to participate, and Protesilaus stops her.
So we get necromancy from the third, we get necromancy from the sixth, we get necromancy from the fourth, and then we get the eighth.
So this is really our first view of what necromancy other than Harrow looks like. Previously, we'd gotten a pretty good view of Harrow, and we had gotten these like throwaway lines about random unnamed nuns. And that was really all we saw. So we didn't have a clean sense of kind of contrast. But here we actually get to see a lot. And I think that we'd gotten information already about the idea that like ghosts like blood, ghosts are sort of hungry for blood in the way that Wake's ghost was introduced. The fourth's response is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
This is the second time that Gideon has seen very young people lose basically their parents, but Harrow didn't have Gideon in the way that Isaac has Jean-Marie.
And I don't imagine that, like, Harrow had any of the room for trying to pivot things that they are, scrambling to try and say, we need answers. Like, Harrow kind of already had the answers and just had to live with that knowledge.
Yeah, I think in some sense, the fact that they're kind of protected from getting too dangerous in their desperation, but they're held in the way that they are able to just stand there and scream is really healthy. Like there's something about the fact that they're given a little bit of protection from people like Camilla, who's like, okay, well, we're done stabbing each other, but yeah, carry on. But that they're able to just inhabit this grief. There's a level of emotional functioning there that is really different from what Harrow had to do. Harrow didn't have the space to just break down.
No, and nor would Harrow really have any clear examples of what that might even be. One of the things that is really strikingly absent in a lot of these books is like any sort of nuance around self-harm. Harrow is inclined to put her body through extraordinary things in pursuit of necromancy. And here, in a moment of extraordinary grief, so is Isaac. So is Jean-Marie. At no point is this framed as some kind of relief or release or method of coping. They are working, they're trying. And that is, I don't know. It's an interesting specter to me of watching two young people grieve and like cut themselves and be in this situation where it's not framed that way. Because so often when this kind of visual is happening with someone this young, you're getting conversations around self-harm.
Part of that is because it's so culturally normative. What they're attempting to do is only a small step beyond what all the adults are doing anyway. Palamedes is offering his blood. Harrow markedly isn't, which I have to imagine is because she doesn't want people noticing anything about her blood.
Yeah, and there's this also this kind of thing that continues to reoccur, which is like the sacrifice of self that comes along with being an adept. Like your body is part of what you lose. Like,
Yeah, and Cavalier as well. Isaac gives his blood first, but when his blood doesn't work, he just goes for Jean-Marie's blood. When Ianthe's blood isn't enough, she starts cannibalizing Babs, and that's clearly a normal part of their relationship.
it's a normal part of the relationship, but it's interesting how, and we've kind of alluded to this before, where like different types of necromancy perceive each other differently, where it's like Gideon is super creeped out by this and like creeped out by soap because it's made of people. There are cultural norms, but they aren't the same within every house. But the normal of your body is not really entirely yours is seems to be a very universal trend between it.
This reminds me quite a lot of bell hooks' observation that in order to begin to oppress women, men first have to harm themselves, and that the way that you train a man to domineer at women is to first treat him to hate and cut at the parts of himself that he recognizes as feminine. And it seems like a really parallel process is happening here, that the necromancers tolerate objectifying the cavaliers because they also objectify themselves. And in order to create a social structure in which people are instrumentalized, in some ways, everybody has to be instrumentalized.
Yeah, and we've talked about how why Abigail and Magnus were first, and how I thought it was, because socially they were a threat. Philosophically, they pushed some of those norms away because of their care for each other was initially outside of that relationship. So I am curious at what that would look like at the instrumentalization of the body within their dynamic when we're presented of two people who are otherwise like so gentle and caring, where it would seem like something like that would not be as comfortable for them. While like Ianthe eating Babs, like, yeah, that checks out.
I think we see Abigail and Magnus's personalities and their relationship through the lens of Gideon, who has only ever known torture and abuse. And I think that Magnus and Abigail's relationship would look less wholesome if you and I saw it through the context of our actual friends and family. I think
Sure.
that that relationship probably is actually a lot more fucked up. It's just that it's not fucked up in the context of the locked tomb. And Gideon doesn't have the tools to recognize what's fucked up about it. And like that has to be true in a sense because whatever else was happening in their relationship, they were also fostering child soldiers. They were participating in the child soldier project. And like
Yeah.
maybe they felt like that was the only way to protect these kids for as long as they could or whatever. But like, they were participating in the child soldier project. They were training child soldiers. So, like, their wholesomeness is contextual.
Totally, absolutely. And Muir is so particular about being very specific about what the narrator knows and doesn't know. And like this incomplete knowledge of the unreliable narrator is very much part of Muir's writing style between all of the books. And it is both like something that obscures information but also that highlights information simultaneously. Like there's also this part of me that's like, what, is Gideon not seeing? What is Gideon not noticing? And the first one we talked about was like the conspicuous lack of sweat of Corona Beth. Like she's not seeing that within the larger context of like all the other necromancers are actually being like pretty intense about this. And like Corona's like, whatever, this is chill. I'm just like here with my sister. We're doing our thing.
Another thing that she doesn't clock that I think is really interesting is in her telling of this scene, at some point, Dulcinea drifts into the room, which is fine,
Yeah.
except how do you get into this room?
Holy shit.
The ladder that's right there. If she had come down the ladder with great difficulty because of her physical disability, that would not have been placidly drifting into the room unnoticed.
And
How do
goodness
you
knows.
unnoticed enter this room?
Yeah, and Protesilaus doesn't really move in any sort of subtle way either.
From whence did they drift?
Okay, so there's an interesting question of what Judith is doing right now, and I could see there being a very mundane answer of like she's securing the perimeter or something like that, or getting teacher, or there could be a very practical, boring answer to this question. A lot of what Judith does never really seems to be quite striking or dramatic. It's very like mundane, predictable by the book. She starts to take up a bit of a bigger role after this as the kind of representative of the cohort, as a bit of a an enforcer type of position. But at this point, like, it tells us that her type of necromancy perhaps doesn't apply here.
I don't know that we ever see Judith and Marta go into the facility either. This is the first time the fourth has gone into the facility because previously they weren't allowed. Other than Judith and Marta, this is everybody in the facility. But I don't know that Judith and Marta ever go into the facility later either. It might be that this is, especially after a murder there, just viewed as too much of a security risk.
It does ask the question of like, What is Judith doing in terms of pursuit of the knowledge of Lictorhood? It's missing a big part of what's there to opt out of it entirely.
Judith and Marta are low-ranking officers. It is possible that they went to teacher, and teacher said, if you go down there, you're going to get murdered by ghosts. And they went, heard. We'll just
Yeah.
go ahead and not do that then.
Yeah. How about we don't get murdered by ghosts, therefore have an opportunity to investigate further? Yet to be speculated upon.
It's so touching, the moment of Palamedes quietly saying, excuse me, to Abigail's corpse when he accidentally passes too close to it. That is extremely relatable and also a really beautiful vignette of who he is. You know, he's tired and he's distracted, and his automatic reaction is humanizing and polite.
Yeah, and it's an interesting contrast to this instrumentalization of the body. Like, this body is still Abigail's and deserving of regard and res like it means that there is still this fundamental recognition that this is her body. This isn't someone else's body to be utilized for the sake of the empire. This is Abigail.
We didn't talk about this during the dinner party, but all of the scions of the various houses have noble or military or clerical ranks, and they're not similar to one another. Each house has a different rank, and so you can't quite put them in a single order because they're different kinds of ranks. But of all of the people who have noble titles, Abigail and Magnus are the lowest ranking. And it's interesting to see how people respond to them with such respect and such dignity, given that presumably they outrank them and in some cases far outrank them. Like the distance between a lady and a princess is enormous.
Because it's interesting that I wonder if this has to do with the order of the houses or if it's completely separate from that.
It's certainly not in the order of the houses. I kind of did some noodling about that recently, and it's really surprising because the second house is captain and first lieutenant, which is quite low ranking and certainly not the highest ranking. Like the cohort has to have generals and stuff. And of course, we know that Admiral Sarpedon will outrank Judith. The third house is princesses and a prince. The fourth house is baron. The fifth house is lady. But then down in the seventh house, you get a duchess. So it's very much not in-house order.
I as you described it, I was thinking of, John's cultural construction of the empire and, how this maybe might have been in order of how he constructed a society that delivered on his idea of control and order. And so, it's by purpose. Like the second are tools of the first. They and having nobles is superfluous while you're initially trying to establish that control. They would, vie for power and create conflict unnecessarily, while you're, as emperor, still trying to get shit together. But once you start distributing power, having people who claim that power and claim their identity along with it, would help create like succession, and control of that power staying where you put it. Then the fourth is also military. And I get confused about this sometimes, that Judith and Marta and Isaac and Jean Marie both are kind of conveyed as
As military, but Judith and Marta only have their cohort ranks, whereas Isaac and Jean-Marie are listed as Baron and Knight of Tisus. And then Pro is also a knight. So there's knights in multiple houses as well, and Templars are knights. So the eighth are both knights as well. It's weird. The way that the noble houses, like it certainly doesn't seem to be the case that all of the houses are equals, but it also doesn't seem to follow that the noble titles work in the same order of sort of priority that they work in for instance, the English court. So it's interesting. It's not clear kind of what is happening with that. And the sort of gravitas of the fifth really highlights that.
We have this, really tender moment of Palamedes recognizing Abigail's humanity, and that's one of those like time dilation shifting moments in this chapter. And I think, one of the first ones where you're just like you focus in because you've gone from this like big description, and now you're kind of watching behaviors, watching kind of general behaviors from a general description, and then you have this one very particular moment, and then you zoom back out. And it's also like, I think part of maybe the, because I was thinking about, Muir's tendency to have this contrast, this first and second contrast in the way she writes. And maybe that is where the duality comes in this chapter, is the like zoom out, zoom in, zoom out, zoom in. And perhaps, she's not using that literary tool in this chapter, but I looked for it anyway, and that's as much where I found it.
In this very exceptional moment, much of what we see is how the Necrocavalier pairs habitually treat one another. We see in the fourth this extreme grief, but they fall towards one another. They fall in, they catch one another. In the third, you see this dynamic where Coronabeth is just quietly tending to Ianthe. In a way that through their sort of public performance, it seems like Ianthe and Nibirius are orbiting around Corona. But when they get down to it, Corona and Nibirius are actually orbiting around Ianthe, where Corona is pulling her hair back and switching out tools and just tending to her. And Nibirius is offering his body to her use to fuel her. And you see this really fake moment where Protesilaus stops Dulcinea from interacting. And it's sort of like it fools Gideon. But in this scene, Protesilaus, or, Kithaera is pretending that Protesilaus is sort of in charge, that he's the one making decisions. And you don't see that as happening in these other cavalier necromancer relationships. With the possible exception of Judith and Marta, because their relationship is a bit dysfunctional.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of that is Kithraea, like, and her perception of this dynamic. 'Cause like, did she know anything about the relationship that the real Dulcinea and the real Protesilaus had? Because when we are in the bubble in the next book, like, the vibes are so different.
Yeah, I don't think that she had a good reading, and I think that she is motivated mostly by what works in the scene to explain her behavior. Like, she isn't going to actually try to summon their souls back. She could do it. She's mega powerful. And so she needs to keep good faith with the others while not actually helping. And so making it seem like Pro is protecting her because she's just too frail to do real necromancy, kind of like offloads responsibility.
Yeah.
And then, of course, late in this scene, Silas is starting to actually get the souls back, and Protesilaus hauls off and decks him.
Yeah.
And she frames it as if he has started to siphon her, and Protesilaus is acting protectively and totally under his own steam. But of course, she just doesn't want the soul back.
Yeah. It puts that soul siphoning in a very particular light of like it can do something that none of the other necromancy can accomplish. It conveys the power of that, and it is the first time we see necromancy as like threatening someone. And in this way it's not like a direct threat, but Kithaera has to act to stop someone in a very direct way that like she kills Abigail and Magnus to prevent them from like figuring out the puzzle and uncovering her and possibly unifying the others against her. But it's interesting just seeing what necromancy actually causes a bit of a complication for a lictor.
It suggests as well that as we see elsewhere, there's this balance between like part of what puts a limit on how powerful you can be as a necromancer is what you're willing to do. Eonthe gets more powerful by cannibalizing her living cousin, probably. Not everybody's willing to do that. Silas is able to do this immense, powerful thing by spiritually cannibalizing his nephew,
And
which not everyone's willing to do.
it does frame it as a lot more taboo.
And it's interesting to see the contrast between Gideon's revulsion at Eonthe biting Nibirius's hand versus the general sort of reaction to soul siphoning.
Yeah, 'cause like in a way, like hair, nails, like barely registers as cannibalism to me.
She does also bite the heel of his hand, and she's getting the chunk of hair out by I think biting like his whole head. I don't know. I don't think she's just nibbling on the edge of the fingernail. She's
Okay.
getting weird shit in there.
Sure. That she would. There's definitely like more horror and general like what the fuck as this like slow drawn out, 'cause it's like an afterthought of like, oh, that's nasty. I'm gonna lose my dinner. Like, bleh, I'm gonna look at Cronabeth being hot to try and recover. But like the slow horror and like light show and column draining, like this is now, well, so we've had this slow description and then these scaled back and then like focused in. And with Silas's necromancy, it feels like the slowest description.
Yeah, I think the most space is given to this. There's these other moments throughout the chapter where we get a couple of sentences or maybe a paragraph, but the soul siphoning is, I think, more than a page before the punch.
Yeah, and the time dilation effect in the language is suddenly so striking. This is the first one too where Gideon is having a physical response and a physical impact of it, being in proximity with it, seeing it. She's like, me too. Like everyone is being affected by this process.
Oh, that's interesting. I felt like the thing that was happening was that Silas was not able to succeed siphoning only Colm, and so he actually started siphoning other people.
Yeah. Gideon felt an internal tug. It was a bit like the sensation back in response, something deep inside her. So something is happening deep inside her. She's feeling this. And then other things in the space are also reacting, electric things. Like we are seeing an ambient, like, area of effect
Yeah, it
siphoning
is
that is
fucking with
happening.
the way that the world works in the immediate area.
Yeah.
One of the things that I noticed on this reread was that when Silas starts taking Colm's soul into himself, he glows iridescent white, which is the signature color of the first house. So the robes of the first house and the crown of the emperor are the color of taking another person's soul into you.
This is such a beautiful and subtle example of the way that Tamsin Muir keeps using light as a storytelling and like an environment setting tool. Because I totally didn't clock that, but that like is really striking. And it also would be something that they wouldn't really have seen in other contexts.
All of the people who are lictors know exactly what this color means, but most people, it's just pretty. It's just, Harrow describes it as mother of pearl. Like she's not saying, oh, this is the color of soul siphoning.
Yeah. It's interesting that something that is both taboo and destructive, like in terms of just Colm's physical experience, is like beautiful. Like the most horrifying thing that we've been presented with so far in terms of necromancy is also one of the most visually stunning. And there's something insidious but also like seductive about that.
Yeah, I think it's very literal, very straightforward in like Colm gets less alive and Silas gets more alive.
Yeah.
And everybody can tell that that's what's happening. It's not unclear. And you get the sense that most of the people in this room have heard of this before. The necromancers know what it is by seeing it, but have not seen it before. Somebody says, "So it's real." Somebody says, "What is he doing?" Harrow has language for it, but Gideon doesn't.
The disdain that Silas has towards the ninth is so fascinating, given that it seems like it's his necromancy that's most taboo. Like, it seems like bone necromancy is actually pretty fucking mundane compared to a lot of this stuff.
I think the bone necromancy isn't the thing that he objects to, though.
Oh, okay.
I think the tomb itself is the thing that he's mad about.
Okay.
Based on what he says, and we'll get there later, but what he says to Gideon is like, "You were given one job, and it was to keep this buried and forgotten, and instead you made a fucking cult about it and worshipped it." And
Okay.
so I don't think he cares what kind of necromancy they're doing. I think it's a religious objection.
Fair enough. The bone magician thing is so interesting because, like, in the way I know I was listening to the audiobook, in the way that Moira Kerr kind of expresses Harrow's response to it, it's one of the few, maybe first situation in which, like, Harrow is almost chided, shamed, like, treated. Like, bone magician is, it feels derogatory. And it hurts her. Like, she has this polite kind of fawning response of like, "You're pardoned," like, and doesn't engage.
Yeah, I do agree with that. You see later, she has a really similar response to flesh magic. She thinks flesh magic is kind of gross and creepy. So I got the sense largely that it wasn't that, different kinds of necromancy were necessarily like culturally ranked, and more that everybody likes their thing and thinks your thing is weird.
And if we're looking at like the way kind of cults normalize whatever thing upholds their strategy at controlling people, that totally makes sense because like my thing makes sense, but your thing is bad and like you shouldn't do it. Which like as a way of keeping power divided so that they can't unify and so the empire continues to operate under a structure, competing cults, brilliant.
Totally.
Because a lot of them are coming into this with a bit of competitiveness, which is weirdly unnecessary given the fact that like he had a bunch of lictors that from different houses and that was never framed as a competitive thing between those guys.
It doesn't seem like John really intended for the houses to be at odds with one another in the way that they are, but that this is sort of a natural result of both geographic remoteness and resource scarcity.
And if we look at like the falls of empires, that is often like your power structures that formerly served, upholding this figurehead at the top start eating each other.
Totally. We get another indication as Silas is siphoning from Gideon, that the process of using another person's soul as fuel is extremely painful.
Yeah. And like we, have talked about how Gideon's experience with pain is not that of a normal person. So the fact that this is registering quite strongly for her, we scale it to, this kid has already died multiple times and like dislocates her knee and doesn't even register it and like extraordinarily painful. And she's not
And
even aware of what's really happening. It's just like something is terribly wrong and it hurts.
the sense of a blanket being pulled off in the cold is, it's such a small thing, but it's so evocative. And it seems like this is a violation that sort of doesn't need to be mentioned. When Protesilaus punches Silas to stop him siphoning, presumably Dulcinea, there isn't a general outcry. There isn't a sense of like, you can't be attacking people. Everybody's like, yeah, I mean that, yeah, you're allowed to eat your own cavalier, but you are not allowed to eat my cavalier. And perhaps the real taboo violation there is he seems to have also siphoned other necromancers.
Yeah. Silas is interesting because he presents himself as someone who is like a paragon of something, of correctness, and he's better than the others. He really tries to convey himself this way. And even Colm's indifference and aloofness kind of upholds that, but he's absolutely willing to transgress these boundaries that seem to normally govern day-to-day necromancy.
It is possible that in the Templars, the idea that only the Cavaliers are expendable simply doesn't apply in the same way that it doesn't apply on the Fourth. The Fourth necromancers are expendable. They're not to be expended foolishly, but they are to be expended. And it's possible that there's a sort of necromantic humility in the Eighth that everybody's just cattle.
Yeah, Colm's relationship to his own existence could support that for sure. There's a kind of sorrow in the way he carries himself, but there's no resistance. There's just this like tired resignation. We already have this degree of like dehumanization, your body isn't yours, that kind of comes with this world, this universe in general. But to see it like compared against different houses of like some have like, oh, there's a line. Where's your line? My line's in somewhere different. And then, there's people who are just like, why have a line anymore? Why bother? This is what
So
we
it's
do.
interesting in that context that when Silas finds out what Lictorhood is, he finds it disgusting. Like, why not? Why not? If you're
Yeah.
already going to eat his soul, why stop when he's dead?
Yeah. I did remember on my fir I remembered on my first read that I was like totally stunned by that piece. I was like, what is like, yeah. I mean, and when we get to that part, maybe something will clue in that of why there's that distinction. But that made absolutely no sense to me in my first read, and like a lot of things didn't make sense to me my first read. But that explicitly, I was like, this is out of his character. Like, he seems the most likely to be super stoked on the Lictorhood deal. And yet,
I would be interested in reading an eighth sermon. I don't think I'd
yeah.
like it. I just want to know what's in there.
Yeah, fair. You read lots of things you don't like. It's kind of
That's
some
my
of what
job.
you
That's
do.
true.
Yeah.
Gross. Let me smell it.
Yeah. We have this moment of soul siphoning. Like, there's points of light being described in various pieces. We have the torches flickering, we have the iridescence and the emanating of this white light, and the lights crackled and blazed back to life. It's this kind of completing, there's the light, and then there's this kind of temperature shift. And there's a bit of like what feels like a breath to just kind of observe. Gideon's like, now what? And notices the lack of something happening.
Yeah, Gideon notices the lack of response, particularly from Colm, that Protesilaus punches Silas in the face, and Gideon snaps to Colm that is Colm now going to attack Protesilaus? And Colm and Protesilaus are standing there, both like crude sculptures of men. They're both like he's probably still pretty zoned out from having his soul half it.
Yeah. I wonder what's going through Dulcinea's mind in that moment. This dual performance that she's constantly doing is so fascinating to me because I wonder about like her capacity to both perform herself while puppeting Protesilaus. Like, yeah, it's necromancy, but it's also like a weird kind of multitasking.
I have to imagine that the thing going through Kithareya's mind at this moment is, holy shit, that was close. Because Silas was getting the soul back. The
Yeah.
body of Abigail was stirring and
Yeah.
was shivering, and there was this blue sparking light within the corpse. He was about to get an answer from Abigail's soul. Kithareya has got to just be like, holy shit, I got to step this up.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the chapter that like last chapter was an escalation. The escalation really starts to ramp up. Confirmed by this striking difference in temperament and personality and behavior of teacher. Like,
Yes.
he's a whole different guy right now.
Teacher has gone from being this cheerful, kind of gossipy, sort of silly girl's girl to abject terror and telling people what to do. He's not laying clues. He's not welcoming. He's not servile. He's like, y'all need to get out of there or you're gonna die.
And there's, I think, a real sincere desperation in him realizing that he cannot help them.
Yeah.
Like, he's begging them to follow his direction. Not because he thinks they owe it to him, but because he is responsible for their safety in this moment.
He just doesn't want to see them all die.
Yeah. He's like, I'm here to help you guys become lictors. Like, you can't do it if you stay down there. And knowing, what horrors staying down there would lead to.
Now, do you think that he cannot go into the facility because he is programmed not to, or do you think that this is a free will expression of his genuine fear?
I think he is like when he talks about a nest for something else, I think he is at risk of being taken over by something
Ooh.
else.
Ooh,
He
I didn't
doesn't
think of
have
that.
his own soul thing. He's an automaton. He's a complex creation. The people who run him set him to program, and he's auto going now. And he knows that something down there can overrun his programming.
That is a fascinating and terrible possibility.
He's a complex construct.
Yeah, this also introduces the idea that there's something down in the facility that can take over people when they are left empty. That when your soul is pulled out of your body then becomes vacant and habitable. And that there's stuff down there, but not in their living quarters, that just cannot wait to move in.
I think of like the architectural necessities of keeping that all in the vault. Like what is it, like, 6 inches of lead all around it? Like what is it that makes it them able to like keep it in that container? And teacher is like around the top being like, I don't want to go down in there. Like, that's the deeper I go, the more dangerous it is.
Later, we see as they like traverse the river, there are these blood wards to stop the hungry ghosts for minutes at a time. And
Yeah.
something has kept the hungry ghosts confined to the facility for thousands of years.
There's a book called Scholomance. It's actually a trilogy. It is similar genre in terms of traumatized magic children try and save the world against itself. Love that genre. But one of the interesting things about it is that so there's a magical school. The magical school is powered by eating the children. Yeah, it is deeply horrifying for those children from the beginning, but better than the alternative. And so, like, I think of these things that are designed to consume people as part of their mechanism. Like, a blood ward lasts 4 minutes. Now, that's in the river, which is the scale, like a tarp holding up a dam. Like, the scale is a little bit different here, but we're still talking about an enormous threat. Either there is some kind of permanent material, sustainable, like solid static way of doing this, or there is some kind of ongoing draw fueling it,
Yeah.
which like makes me think about the rest of the planet in some ways. It's one big battery keeping the thing in there.
So teacher insists that they get the bodies up out of the facility and get out of the facility themselves, that the empty bodies are the source of danger for everyone. And so we learn that like it's vitally important not to leave a dead person in the facility. Or a person who, like Colum, is a little bit emptied out.
Yeah, if there's a void that something can hop into and start working its way in, it will.
He insists that they get the bodies out, and Palamedes and Camilla are like, no, it's totally good. It's totally fine. We're doing an investigation. We know what we're doing. And he's like, you don't.
Yeah, and his language has completely changed.
Completely.
Which, if we think of this as still in alignment with the priorities that he has been following this whole time. So, follow the directives of the emperor, protect the emperor's secrets, serve the houses, help forward the emperor's message for his assumption. He wants these kids to succeed. He wants them to not die. And he is like pushing his role as a servant, as an agent. And now like it's this fine line between begging and authority.
I think the fact that he refers to them as children, he addresses them as children, is something that is deeply authentic. He hasn't called them children in the past. He has treated them with a very formal level of respect, despite, like I said, being a very sort of intimate, chatty, gossipy person. He has been addressing them with dignity and as their status. And the fact that he's calling them children in this moment of panic really shows that that's how he actually views them. He views all of them as children, not just the fourth and not just the fourth and the ninth, but Colm is just as much of a child to him as Isaac is.
I know we haven't really determined whether or not teacher like feels in the way that we as people feel, but we've talked about how the probability of him being aware of Kithraea's actual identity. It would be in this moment that he might start suspecting that there is a much bigger problem at hand.
Yes. And it seems like he is reading what killed the fifth as the Hungry Ghosts. I don't think he, at this moment, thinks that Kithaera would murder pre-lictors. I think that he knows that it's Kithaera, but I don't imagine that he thinks Kithaera is a threat.
She just happens to be down there with him,
Yeah. I
with
think
them.
he doesn't necessarily know why she would be there, but assumes that it's all part of John's plan, which, like, you would, if you knew her as one of the saints and gestures, and then she appeared unexpectedly, your mind would not naturally go to she has been flipped by a terrorist organization, is going to do a whole lot of murder.
I mean, she's the highest ranking, most informed person here. His nature would be to defer to her. His programming and instinct would be to defer to her and to assume that she is also like him, expressing the will of Jod.
So we close this chapter with this admonition that everyone is absolutely not safe. Abigail and Magnus are already dead, and if they stay down in the facility, even right at the door of the ladder, they are all in immediate mortal danger.
Have they been the whole time they've been down there and they've only been insulated by the fact that their souls are still intact within their bodies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're in mortal danger the whole time they're in the facility, no matter what they're doing. One thing that I wonder is, why did Teacher arrive right at that moment? Did he sense the soul siphoning? Is he there because that happened? Or is it just that he arrived at that moment?
Yeah, what brought teacher? We
As you
have.
say, did Marta go tell Teacher?
Yeah, we have Marta. We have soul siphoning. We have. Is he aware that an adept has just died? Not in the not too long ago. Like, what? We go back to how much does teacher sense?
Yeah, it's been several hours. So it seems like it wasn't sort of an immediate knowledge that people had died. But what is Teacher's experience of this moment? Did he just notice that everybody was suddenly spending a lot of time in the middle of the night down in the facility and asked someone, "Hey, what's up?" And some person sitting in the dining room, bleary-eyed, having a cup of tea after spending hours in the basement was like, "Oh yeah, it's crazy down there."
How teacher found out about this moment would be very illuminating.
I also wonder about the process of them telling each other, because Harrow and Gideon discovered the body, and then everyone is coming in and out.
I can't imagine Harrow and Gideon wanting to leave the bodies alone, but I also imagine Gideon would be very reluctant to leave Harrow alone. immediately after finding those bodies.
I also can't imagine that either Gideon or Harrow's reaction to finding the bodies would be like, we better get the team on this. Like, that's not how either of them is.
I don't think, no, Harrow could have sent a skeleton.
Oh, she could have. I just don't think she would. They're both very, very secretive. Neither of them is inclined to share information, and they don't really have what they feel is a friendship with anybody yet, where they would really volunteer information. Palamedes is trying to make friendship happen, but Harrow is not yet to a point where she is freely sharing information with Palamedes.
The odds of Palamedes and Camilla being down there are decently high.
Yeah, I think it's very likely that they happened upon the bodies and started investigating, and then someone else happened upon them. And at that point, maybe f went and told other people.
The thing that I want to know is, was it an individual or a pair that went and told people? Because at that point, I would imagine Camilla would feel increasingly protective of Palamedes. I feel like everyone's guard would be higher. Like the idea of a pair splitting up seems much less probable. Like Marta and Judith just being like, yeah, we'll go tell them, and then fucking off entirely. Like that's the most probable, but that would have meant that they were down there before and then decided to be completely uninvolved about the rest.
Yeah, which they don't seem like the type to just sort of leave others to it.
This chapter feels like a bit of a haze in a way that I think makes a lot of sense for this kind of experience, because this is the first time Gideon's come across a situation like this. Like, yes, people die on the ninth. Yes, weird shit happens to bodies on the ninth, but it's all within a mundane routine kind of pattern. Like,
Gideon isn't habitually exposed to violence, except violence to her, and that doesn't have any stakes.
and there's just this like almost dreamlike quality to the time dilation and to the distance and then focus of this chapter, which makes me very curious to see the nature of the writing as we go into 18.
Yeah, I think that dreamlike quality really captures the fact that Gideon is exhausted. They had already had kind of a long day before going to the dinner party, and then they went down into the facility after the dinner party, ran transference winnowing to completion, and then found the bodies.
This day is
So
four heavily character affecting chapters long.
it's so long, and she's had so many people fuck with her body mind. She's had so many unusual sensations. She fought this skeleton over and over and over. She's exhausted. And then she's now done what, like 6 hours of helplessly watching as necromancers try to solve a problem that she can't contribute to.
Gideon is so exhausted, she is not even really perceiving the world in the way that she had been before.
Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art features Claire and Han as Magnus and Abigail. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Or get our attention online at #nunpod. Hey, have you been checking the episode notes? There's stuff in the episode notes. Thanks for listening.